This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, now a married man, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, I'm glad to see that you did pull off the ceremony successfully. You were not thrown into the fire caves. You were not brought into the Celestial Temple before you could actually, you know, say I do.
No, Chris, I wasn't, Thank the Lord, or thank the prophets. Luckily, you know, what I left behind was just singlehood. And so everything has been going great. We've had a really good time just the first week and enjoyed some downtime a little bit. And we had a good time on our honeymoon as well. So sorry, guys, for being gone, but I had some more important things to accomplish. And now it's great to be back, though, Chris, just getting a chance to get behind the mic. And, you know, I was thinking about the fact that we are finally here. This is the very last show in this series. And, it, you know, like the episode, it leaves me a little teary to think that we're going to be done talking about, you know, the finale of Deep Space Nine. And brings back a lot of memories, you know, as we talked about it for our first episode and now thinking about it again for our second episode, of just what it was like to, mm-hmm. I never felt that feeling before, that kind of crushing weight of like, oh man, it's over.
Yeah. Well, so. It reminds me, after the first part of our discussion here about What You Leave Behind came out this week, and Ruth Ward, who is an associate producer of the show here, but in our listeners group, the Babel Conference on Facebook, Ruth said, "I love and hate this episode. It's an excellent send-off. I hate watching it because it makes me cry, because it's over. I can't stand that the story is done. I just can't let go of these folks. I can watch the first half fine, but the second half, the goodbyes, no, it's just too much."
Well, it is. You know, the moment that you get to them all, you know, standing around, and Vic's, and he's singing, and yeah, he's talking about the crinkle on her nose, and just, it's a fantastic scene. And then there's that moment where Benjamin just gets the message from the prophets, and he leaves, and you're just, because we've all seen it before, we have this sinking feeling knowing that this is the end, mm-hmm. and it's not going to end up that kind of happy-go-lucky that the Next Generation did, where, you know, Picard sits down at the table and you're left with this very hopeful feeling. You know, this one is, it's really bittersweet. It's melancholy. It's very Deep Space Nine.
Definitely. So if you're listening to this, if you're new to The Orb and you're tuning into this episode, this is actually the 10th episode in our series about the final chapter. And Matthew, I was thinking, like, how am I going to name these? Because we originally were planning to maybe do one really long episode at the end or just do nine. So this is going to be sort of like part 10 of nine I think, for us here.
It's a really, really weird Borg collective.
Yeah, 10 of 9. There's just that straggler that won't leave.
Well, you know, actually, Chris, what we're doing is just following in the footsteps of many films these days that take one book at the very end of the series and break it into two parts. So, you know, yeah, we had Harry Potter in parts 1 and 2. Right. We're getting, you know, the Hunger Games film that way. So we're just following in those footsteps.
Well, Matthew, as I've told you before, and I think maybe it may have been the last show even, big difference between them and us is that we're not selling this podcast, and therefore we don't have that motivation to split it up in two so we can get double box office.
It was all motivated by love, really.
Yeah, that's right.
We, for us, it's we just had too much to talk about in one episode, and you know, finding the time for both of us to sit down and talk for you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours, which we would have done, is tough for both of us. So I'm glad that we're doing this, though, because there were a lot of things that we did not get to kind of jump into in that first episode. Whereas here, we're going to finally get to talk through some characters and kind of really just put a nice big bow on everything that we've talked about over the last, 9 months now.
Right. Quark will be happy to sell you that nice big bow for the right price.
That's true. That's true. I was thinking maybe instead he could, you know, give me a nice Sumerian sunset, you know, to relax.
Yeah. Don't you love that Morn gets a final moment in this episode? You get to see Morn that one last time.
Well, you know, it's so funny because, yeah, it is almost that kind of like Cheers ending, uh-huh. You know, where you've got Morn sitting there with Quark, you know, and that's the heart of Deep Space Nine is kind of still there, you know, the promenade and Quark's bar and Morn sitting there, and some things never change.
That's right. So last time we talked about the key story elements. We talked about the Mars Last Stand and the Cardassian Resistance. We talked about the decision by the Alpha Beta Alliance to go in and finish the war. We talked about some parallels to World War II and Odo changing the founders and whether we thought that was an easy out or not. Also, One Last Night in Vix and the great montage of everything that happened over the course of the series, minus Jadzia, and also the showdown in the Fire Caves. And so today we're going to talk in some broader strokes. We're going to talk about how we got from Emissary to What You Leave Behind. We're also going to talk about the character moments in What You Leave Behind that we didn't really touch on last time. And then, again, how this book ends, what they set up in Emissary, and ultimately, what's the legacy of Deep Space Nine? So this is going to be sort of a special part 10 of 9 here at the end, where we just kind of recap both the final chapter and the series as a whole. Now, for anyone worried, if this is the last show of The Orb, it's not. It's just the last episode of our look at the final chapter, and then we'll be moving on. And Matthew, I think we've agreed that the next one we're going to do in terms of a big series like this is going to be the season 6 opening arc, right?
Yeah, Chris, I think that is going to be a lot of fun. You know, that also leads us to a lot of other series. You know, we'll tackle the end of season 6 and 7, I think, sometime as well, because that's quite an arc there. That goes for, I think, 4 or 5 episodes in the end. And then we've got 2-parters to talk about. We've got 3-parters to talk about. You know, so Deep Space Nine is just kind of rife with these great series that we can have. And so I really appreciate it because so many of the people in the Babel Conference and on Twitter have given us some fantastic ideas for series that we can continue to do. And I'm just so glad we get the opportunity to do it because it means we get to go back and talk about and think about some of the very best parts of Deep Space Nine.
Mm, definitely. So let's talk about how we got here, how we got to the final chapter. And how can we frame it? I suppose that when the final chapter kicked in, when we got to Penumbra and we knew we were going to build up to the end of the series here, when you think about everything that we got up to that point, what do you see in terms of how the series itself set up this very unique push to the end in terms of a television series?
Well, I think we were talking on the other side of the orb right before we started recording there that season five, I feel like the creators make a decision that they are going to really use this idea of the emissary and the prophets with Sisko. Now, I don't think that they, even then, they have planned exactly what they're going to do, how they're going to have it all come down in the end, how it's all going to funnel in. But I think that they make the decision, okay, this is something we are going to use. We're going to play with very seriously. And especially, you know, once we start in Rapture and everything that happens with Sisko from then on with the prophets is very deliberate. They just keep building things until, I don't know, maybe Ira Steven Bear had a eureka moment and ran into, you know, Ron maybe Moore's office moment. And was like, exactly, I've got it! You know, so I really see, you know, especially from season five on, there being some building blocks that they are using to kind of set up this idea. And I think that's really cool because in so many other places in Star Trek, I feel like that whole idea of the emissary might just have been something that was set up in the beginning, but doesn't really pay off. And in the same way, I guess, when I look at Voyager and it sets up the whole, you know, Maquis versus Starfleet thing in the beginning and it looks like it's going to be a thing, but then it's not really a thing for very long. And here, they definitely don't forget that. You know, they don't forget this idea of the prophets. They don't forget this idea of the emissary. And that's going to be the kind of through thread throughout the entire series. And so that there is a through line, which is very interesting because Deep Space Nine is the only Star Trek, I think, that really does that until maybe Enterprise, where we kind of have the through line, I think, of Archer and his relationship with the Vulcans and just kind of him as the naive captain going to the more seasoned captain that would kind of
maybe
inform.
Jaded captain a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. But just somebody who would kind of inform more of what we see later on from a Kirk, Picard, a Sisko, a Janeway, those kind of things. So this is the only show I feel like that really, really brings forth pieces from the very beginning all the way to the end. And I know people are probably going to be yelling at their podcast players right now. TNG obviously brings back the whole idea, but that's not necessarily a through line throughout the entire series.
So I see interesting similarities. When I look at TNG and when I look at DS9, it's interesting that two consecutive series both created wonderful bookends where the pilot episode and the finale take an element that was in both and create a story where you feel like, this was amazing. They just brought me full circle. What's interesting is that with The Next Generation, the whole storyline with Q and Encounter at Farpoint wasn't even in that story originally. It was added to the story because the studio wanted a 2-hour episode and Roddenberry wanted a 1-hour episode and they were trying to compromise and the studio said, no, it needs to be 2 hours. And so they had to stretch out that story. And so they added a number of different things to it. But one of the things, the key thing they added was Q. And when we get to All Good Things, we have this wonderful story between Q and Picard, which we even get the same courtroom scenes again. And that would never have been possible if they hadn't added that to Encounter at Farpoint to stretch the story out. So it was really an accident. And likewise with Deep Space Nine, it's easy for us to watch this episode and feel like, wow, what a vision they had to bring Sisko here, to have him meet Kyo Paka, to set up that he was the emissary of the prophets to the Bajoran people, and look what happened in the final episode. But it's really not the case, right? It's just a fascination that Rick Berman and Mike Piller had with this idea of Sisko being this emissary. But there was no grand plan for us to get the book in that we got. So that's one similarity I see in between TNG and DS9, that they both sort of accidentally created this wonderful book in. But the difference that I really see is that with Deep Space Nine, there are so many threads that run through the series and then new ones start and then they all keep running to the end so that when you get to the end, there's just this enormous pile of threads that need to be tied together and you're interested in so many of them. And when you look at TNG, you don't see so many things that can run together like that towards the end. And so there's no need to have a 9-episode finale because you can wrap things up in, you know, I mean, they kind of slowly wrapped up a few things there towards the end, but you have this one great finale, which really is just another story in the long line. But of course, they were going to go on to movies after that.
Well, and it shows that kind of shift in storytelling that Deep Space Nine was creating a little bit more of a serialized nature. And it, obviously, we know from just kind of the background, the studio stopped paying attention to Deep Space Nine and they really just kind of got to do what they wanted. And that's really what they had wanted to do from the beginning. And actually, that's kind of where they wanted to take Voyager as well. They wanted it to be more like that. And the studio at that point said no. So Deep Space Nine just gets very, you know, blessed at that point to have a hands-off studio and a bunch of guys who really want to start telling more intricate, deep stories that are going to have characters evolve, because a lot of them had come from The Next Generation and been frustrated because they weren't able to do
right.
that.
Well, I think that's the key. So definitely, and we've said this many times on the show, that the studio being hands-off on DS9 because they were so focused on Voyager was really important. But like you just said, some of these guys, they were frustrated with the restraints of The Next Generation. And you can see what they did after Deep Space Nine. You know, look at Battlestar Galactica. Look at the 4400. Look at the stories that these people have told after that. This is just the kind of story that they're going to tell. And I get the feeling that if the studio had tried to say, no, you can't do this and you can't do that with the story, they would have probably done it anyway. I almost feel like they would have found a way to still tell this type of in-depth story.
Oh, I think that they would have, you know, especially...
Or they would have left, and the show would have all been over. So.
Well, you know, Ira Steven Behr, I don't think he could have put up with that the amount of 7 years. And, you know, one of the cool things about the writers is, like you were saying, look, I don't think this was a master plan the whole time.
No.
What I think they did is that they kept throwing out things, and if it stuck to the wall, they would come back to it, you know? And if it didn't, they would let it go by the wayside, and you'd forget about it too, really, as the watcher. And so what they kept doing is they kept throwing things to the wall, and then they kind of pick it back out, and then they throw it back up, you know? And so until all these things, by the time they get to the end, it almost feels like, you know, when you watch one of those like NCIS shows or something and they have the guy who has the big collage on the wall and he's got all the threads running through.
Oh, I thought you were talking about David Mack writing Seekers and writing The Fall, actually The Fall, right?
Yeah.
That's where everyone's told us, all the authors have told us that David had this big master plan.
But I feel kind of like the writers must have kind of done that in some ways, that they would see, okay, we had this, 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 and this, this connects, and then they would have that idea, oh, and then we can use it to do this.
Sure, sure.
And so I really feel like, you know, the writers were just really good at that, that they would just throw things out, they would try things. If it really struck their fancy, they just continued to go with it. And that's really, I think, what happens by the time season 5 comes around, and they really start to play with this idea of the prophets, who they are, what they are to Sisko, what their relationship is with him, and Sisko's relationship with Bajor and all of that becomes very interesting. And, as we talked about, it makes for a really interesting arc for a guy who didn't want to be there in the beginning, who comes, you know, does a whole 180 to the point where he never wants to leave Bajor. In fact, you know, he says when he retires from Starfleet, what he would do, he would have a house on Bajor. He builds that house there. You know, Cassidy is going to live there. And she's waiting for him to return at the end of the show. And I just think, what a really amazing story of a guy who had lost everything, lost his, you know, his wife and his home. because home is where his heart is at that point. And Bajor becomes his new home.
Yeah.
And that's definitely where his heart is at the end.
Would you agree that in the fifth season, not even halfway through, so 10th episode is Rapture, right? That Rapture is the key moment that propelled the series towards this finale?
Yes. I think, to me, Rapture is the pivot episode. And I think that there probably are some people out there who really dislike the whole Prophet Pa-Wraith thing.
Oh, definitely.
I know that there are people out there that just really dislike that. And but to me, that's what sets, again, this show apart, was its transcendence of just a storytelling idea to a mythological idea. And it, Deep Space Nine, as we've said over and over again, really touches on those ideas and brings them to fruition in these characters and in their story. And I think that's what's, you know, made it be something that, you know, like so many people on the Babel Conference have been talking about with the last episode. It brings them to tears, mm-hmm. you know, watching that last episode. I don't hear that. I mean, one of our listeners actually today even wrote on there, they were asking, what was it that the episodes that really made you cry in Star Trek? And I thought it was so interesting. Yeah, it was Jeannie. She asked about that, and because she was talking about how similitude always, you know, brings her to tears. Almost every answer starts out with, well, The Visitor, and then they might name a couple others, but I mean, almost every single answer is The Visitor and maybe another episode.
Well, Matthew, I will say that your contribution to that thread was Nemesis because of how bad it is.
Yes, well, you know, it does actually make me cry how bad that film is, but
yeah,
that's a different podcast, Chris.
The other ones that people say, definitely true. You know, someone, actually, John mentioned Real Life from Voyager, which is one that really gets me, especially these days, you know, as a parent. So, well, last show, our first part of our look at What You Leave Behind here, I said at the end, I believe it was when we were talking about the montage, that despite the war and everything else that people point out about Deep Space Nine, that scene in the finale really drives home the point that above everything else, this show is about the characters. And we didn't really talk about all the different character threads that get wrapped up more or less here in What You Leave Behind last time we talked about this. So let's talk about those now. The first one, Ezri and Julian, of course, because that's the first scene that we see, is Ezri in bed with Julian. Now, we've talked throughout the other nine parts of the series that we've done about Ezri and Julian and building up towards that, to their relationship. So how do you feel they did here in bringing that to some sort of a conclusion in the final episode?
You know, I liked it. And I think back to watching it the first time I was younger, and you know, this was one of those first shows that I had watched all the way through from the very beginning. So this was kind of my first ship as well, you know, my relationship on TV that I was really, you know, into at that point. And I was very excited that this finally worked out for them. And it's just a great scene. It's a cute scene. But more than that, I think what it does as well is that, you know, they're both going to go into battle that day. And at this point, they're fighting for the Federation, but they're also fighting for that thing that they both want and that they've found that's worth trying to protect as well. And so it makes it mean so much more in this scene. And I think that's one of the nice things about this is they're not just doing it to pay off the character, but it's still adding to the storyline that they're going to be telling, you know, for the next hour and a half.
Right.
And I really like that. And you know, listening to the Trekland speaker about this, you know, the idea had actually been to maybe even have Julian leave as well, the station. And they decided that too many people were leaving the station, and so they had him stay. And I thought that, you know, that really at that point just worked for that character. You know, he still would want to be on the frontier. I don't think that part's changed, but you've seen him kind of be tempered and molded and become a more mature man, even though he's still playing with models.
Mm-hmm. They're not toys, and models.
No, that's right. Yeah. It's not a
toy. Don't let Molly influence you.
No, not at all. But, you know, he had found somebody who understood him and was okay with who he was. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he does kind of have this big boy side in him. And at the same time, he's still very much a gentleman and a man and all of those things. So I like the relationship. I think it works. I wish we had had more time with it. You know, it really is only in that last 9 episodes that they really start to focus on that, with getting Ezri fixing things with Worf so that she can move forward. And I feel like we could have even used, I mean, we get 9 episodes to wrap up this show, but we could have used, you know, 15, 20.
Well, you could.
And still had plenty of storyline there
that you could tell there for sure. Well, talking about Julian also is his relationship with Miles. And we saw Extreme Measures here at the end of the arc, and that was really important to give them that one last buddy story as they went along. And one moment that I love in this episode is just Miles looking at the figures. You know, he's got Travis there, he finds Travis, and it's just that little scene, actually, that moment sums up so much about the relationship, the friendship between Miles and Jules throughout the series. And it's, no one would have expected it going into the series, but it turned out to be probably one of the best friendships in all of Star Trek. Certainly the best bromance, right?
Well, I mean, I guess since, you know, Kirk and Spock, which this one was, it was so human. I mean, you know, you didn't have to worry about that whole
Spock would be so insulted right now, Matthew.
He would be so insulted.
Said that to him.
But, you know, this was one of those really neat things that they did on Deep Space Nine, and the fact that they really looked at all different types of relationships and lovely relationships that people have and what makes them work. And the way that Miles and Julian come together and really find a way to connect when they don't connect at all at the beginning, you know, is pretty fantastic. So that really heartbreaking scene where Miles finally blurts out that he's leaving is, and the look on Julian's face and the look on Miles' face too, when he finally has to admit to his best friend that he's leaving, you can tell that there's a lot of heartbreak between them. But it was one of those neat things that Deep Space Nine wasn't afraid to do, is to say that people's lives have to move on. Mm-hmm. And you don't always stay on the same ship for, you know, 30 years. A lot of times in this life, this type of life, you move around. And what I thought was so cool about it too was what it was doing for O'Brien, in the sense that we always knew that Keiko wasn't really happy on Deep Space Nine. And I think a lot of the reason for them moving has to do with the fact that he knows that she'll be happier on Earth.
Yep.
Because she'll have a lot more to do as a botanist instead of having to travel to Bajor all the time when she wants to do anything with her specialty, and it'll keep their family together, you know? So the things that we do for family, and you have to make those grown-up decisions, so.
Yeah, well, it was not an ideal situation for them to be on that station in particular.
Not at all. And I mean, obviously, fast-forwarding all the way to the new books, and they've built the brand-new Deep Space Nine, which has the biggest arboretum park ever, you know, that gives Keiko a lot more to do now, but, you know, before that, having to move back to Earth, it I don't know. I think it was just one of those moments and one of those friendships that, you know, it's going to last between them. They're always going to be friends. But it's going to be that hard thing where they're really going to have to work at it in the end. You know, they're not going to be able to not contact each other for years. They're going to have to do the hard part, which is to contact each other and go see each other and that kind of stuff. And, you know, whether or not you've read any of the books or anything like that, if you just want to create your own headcanon, for me, that's what I would say, is that I always felt that they would still be the closest of friends. Mm-hmm. It was just going to be difficult. And
yeah.
It's hard to lose. I mean, you know, my best friend lives in Dallas. That's really far. Yeah.
And you recently moved away. So it's like miles going back to Earth, except Seattle's not quite as far away from Dallas as Earth is from Bajor.
No, it just seems as hard to get back there sometimes.
Could be harder, actually.
Yeah. So, but it was a great wrap up to, I think, one of the best parts of Deep Space Nine, one of the surprises of Deep Space Nine. Yeah. You know, going in, I don't think anybody thought, and especially as you watch through the first couple of seasons, you don't really see that coming.
You know, I always think back to Rivals, which is, you know, an early episode. I always have, and they actually use a clip from that in the montage that they do when Vic is singing. But I always think back to that moment between Miles and Julian, and then where they came. Where they got to in the end.
Yes, that was, oh my gosh. I just think back to what really, really terrible racquetball.
Yeah, I know, space
outfits.
Racquetball, right? Just, they were space racquetball
terrible.
Buddies. Yeah.
Horrible, horrible. Yeah.
Well, another character that we should talk about, both a character and a relationship. The relationship is Odo and Kira. But Odo specifically, this was really interesting. An observation, again, in our listeners group, the Babel Conference, by Josh Perrigo, that I had never really thought of before either, which is that when you get to the end of What You Leave Behind, it's not really just Sisko who fulfills his destiny as an emissary, but actually Odo, when he goes back into the Great Link, is really fulfilling his own destiny as an emissary as well.
That's a really good point. You know, he was definitely sent out to see how Solids would deal with a changeling, and him going back to the Great Link will hopefully change it. I mean, I think that's definitely Odo's idea, is that mm-hmm. hopefully he can create a new view of what it's like to be living among Solids, and that, and I think, you know, Odo of all people and what he experienced really gives him that opportunity, because he's hurt, he's betrayed, he's done all of these things to them, and yet they still accept him, they still trust him, they still believe in him. And he gets to have that very humanoid relationship with mm-hmm. them. He gets to understand what it means to actually live as a humanoid. And I think it creates a really beautiful scene that, you know, he's going to go back to his people, because he doesn't want them to continue on that same path that they've been on, this one of domination, of dominion over people.
Right.
It always makes me wonder what the dominion would look like. And obviously, again, I've read the book, but just thinking of, okay, what will the dominion end up becoming, hopefully, once the founders have digested all that Odo has kind of divulged to them. What will the Dominion look like? Will it be called the Dominion anymore? Would they be called something else? Because that's not quite what they want to be.
Well, the female changeling is gone now, because I was just thinking that if they are the Dominion and they dominate others, then the female changeling is probably called the Dominatrix by everyone in the Great League.
Probably something like that. You know, goo whips and all that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But
what Josh said here was, you know, you're talking about Odo living amongst humans, being in humanoid form. And Josh pointed out that Odo helps bring the war to an end because of his humanity. And, you know, he did go and he did learn to live amongst Solids, and he learned something from them. And he was able to then convey that back to the female changeling and the Great Link as well. and helped in the war. And so, and he was sent out. He was one of the hundred. He was sent out really as an emissary.
Well, and I think, you know, to me, this is really the most fitting end for Odo. Because he's going to be a being who's going to live pretty much forever unless somebody, you know, blows him up with a really high-powered phaser or something like that. He is going to live forever, and therefore, his relationship with Kira already has, you know, an end date for whenever she dies, and he is going to continue alone. And so this is something where, as much as Kira and Odo love each other, she is probably better served going to find somebody else, or... Yeah, it's one of those things, like, you know, when you fall in love with an immortal,
yeah,
and you're not, it doesn't always end up well. I mean, look at Arwen and Aragorn in The Lord of the Rings. He dies and she's left, and she walks the earth alone. And so that's what's going to happen to Odo once, you know, Kira dies. And so this is a really, I think, just a fitting end for who Odo is and his journey, and even for Kira herself.
Well, with Kira, I mean, the scene where they're there at the Great Link, she's taking him back there. You get the feeling that Kira knew all along, too, that this really didn't have a future. You know, it was going to end. And, I mean, that's not something that we think about ourselves, right? I mean, you find a mate, you get married, and you expect that you're going to be together. I mean, you know you're probably not going to die at the same time. Certainly, hopefully you're not, because if you did, it would mean something tragic happened to you both. But you know that, you know, you're probably going to grow old together, and there's going to be a time when you're not together because one of you will die first. But you don't really think about that too much. But with Kira, it did feel like she knew she was going to have to let go.
Yeah, I think she did know that she was going to have to let go. And that's what makes, I think, that ending for her when she's standing there with Jake and they've both lost people. And what's most interesting, and think about this, they've both lost people in very much the same way, because his dad's turned out to be a god and her boyfriend has turned out to be a god in depending on, you know, how you look at it from a certain point of view. But at least at this point, they're both immortal. You know, Sisko can live forever with the prophets. He never has to come back, and Jake doesn't know if he ever will. And then, of course, you know, Odo can live forever. And so both of them are kind of being left to live their lives, never knowing if they'll see that loved one again, but also knowing that loved one could go on for a very long time without them.
Yeah, that's the key, right? That they... And that's one reason that scene is so great at the end, and the choice of those two characters in particular is that they both have lost someone, but they know that that person is still out there.
I was going to sing Celine Dion, but I'm not going to.
You know, I think listeners will tune out if you start singing. I mean, people like to hear you sing, Matthew. They tell us, you know, they really enjoy your little jingles and ditties. But I think Celine Dion might be crossing the line.
Yeah, I thought so too, and that's exactly why these lips are sealed.
Even for our Canadian listeners. the other observation, and let's transition and talk about Sisko and Cassidy a little bit, but as a bridge between Odo and Sisko here, they have both existed in solid humanoid form throughout the course of the series, and then they both go to nebulous places at the end. You know, Sisko's with the prophets. He's not necessarily humanoid anymore. Cassidy goes there. She has the vision. She goes there. She talks to him. But again, that really was all in her mind. We really don't know what the prophets are. You know, we see them in the form of energy sometimes, as with the Pa Wraiths. And so that was interesting too, just the transition from being solid humanoid form for both Odo and Sisko going to these nebulous places. But what about Ben and Cassidy? What do you think about Cassidy? They both come to the realization that, okay, this is what the prophets were warning us of. This is the great sorrow.
Well, and it's interesting because, you know, it is a great sorrow. Ben is going to miss something. But at the same time, what I really liked about the ambiguity of it was, like the Doctor, he can come back at the same time he left, and he will have not aged. So it the way that they set that up, I loved that Ben was like, I don't know when I'll come back. I could come back tomorrow or yesterday. You know, so there's no set time limit because time has no meaning for him anymore. And to me, that was a fault of the novels, is that I really don't think they dealt with that very well. I don't think they dealt with Ben's time mm-hmm. with the prophets, how he would have changed after that. I mean, I just don't think that they... I just don't think it's been dealt with well. And I think that Ben would come back a very different person. And, you know, my guess is that he would have knowledge and understanding that nobody else in the universe has ever had because of the ability to transcend space and time and what he'd be learning from the prophets. And in some ways, maybe what he might be teaching them about what it means to be, you know, corporeal and a humanoid and live a linear life and all of those kind of things. There's so much there. That's such a cool idea. And it just doesn't really get explored. So with Cassidy and the fact that she might not have to miss anything because he could come back. I don't know. To me, that was a really cool thing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, she could be without him for a few years and, you know, be raising a daughter on her own, and him he might miss that. And so that when he did come back, there would be sorrow that he had missed that point of his daughter's life.
Yeah.
That's what it turns out. They have a daughter in the books.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts here, but actually I'm going to save them for the next section of our discussion here about him coming back and what you think about a few of those things. I don't know, the way they wrapped it up, yeah, I think it was done well. Cassidy going to talk to him after he's in the Celestial Temple was nice. And, you know, I'm sometimes critical of Penny Johnson's portrayal of Cassidy. I think it's off and on. Like, sometimes it works really well, and sometimes I feel like there's this awkwardness in her acting and her portrayal of the character. But I do think here, I think that she played Cassidy really well, and I think the dynamic between Sisko and Cassidy throughout What You Leave Behind really conveys sort of the sense of impending loss.
Well, and I mean, I can't think of a worse time to lose your husband than you're pregnant with y'all's first child, and, you know, you have just been getting to know
each
other.
Well, and the war is waging around you as well.
Exactly. And it's finally over. And you're the thought that, okay, now that you could rest for a while and be happy together. And obviously Benjamin's been building a house on Bajor that you can live in. And all of these things, all of these plans, all these thoughts of her expectations of what life was going to be like. And then it's suddenly uprooted for her and it's all gone. And she has no idea if she'll ever have the opportunity to see him again, really, or live life with him at all. And she only has to hold on to that promise that she has from him that he will come back. And so, yeah, it is for her, I think it's a bittersweet story end, you know, because we don't have any closure to the storyline.
And that was very fitting for Deep Space Nine. Right. I think this is a series where if they had a nice, neat ending, I would have been disappointed.
Oh, yeah. I don't think. And that was, again, I think that was a reaction to the ending of The Next Generation, and that these writers saw this idea differently. Life changes. And you know, it's funny because that was all good things. And the end of that must come to an end.
Yeah.
But all good things didn't come to an end. It just kept going, well, you know, whereas this is very fitting, you know, What You Leave Behind.
It's kind of hard for me to be critical of TNG for that, because the entire setup was that as soon as we wrap on this, we're going to go start shooting a movie. So you can't really send everyone off. I think...
Hello, generations!
I think TNG finally got there in Nemesis. It just took them too long to get there, I think. Everyone just felt stagnant for so long. And Yeah, but I don't know. I can't be very critical of TNG for
well,
now.
And I'm not. I'm really not bashing that at all, sure, because that is a fantastic, amazing episode. I think that the more the reaction was is this idea of these guys knew these characters weren't going to be seen again.
Well, right, because if DS9 were going to go to the big screen right after this, we would have gotten a very different ending to this series.
Exactly. And so they are giving them that ending where you can still wonder what happens to them, but you can kind of feel some closure well. And so this is much more that kind of classic TV ending where a show knows it is going to end and they're doing their best to give you what they think is the best wrap up for the characters they've been creating for so many
years. But not wrap up everything, because this particular series is a series where if everything wrapped up neatly at the end, you would feel cheated by everything that was set up before. Like, it doesn't fit with the theme and the tone of the show. So I'm glad that some people got good send-offs and some people were left, like we said, Jake and Kira were left hanging, standing there wondering,
well, it's,
when are our loved ones going to come back?
And it's one of those things, Chris, that really makes Deep Space Nine, in a lot of ways, the most realistic of the Star Trek series, because it, you know, these characters had a station that they were sent to, and they did their duty, and they were there for, you know, 7 years together, and then it's time to move on to the next stop, you know, and especially in a organization like Starfleet, which is a military structure, you usually don't stay at one post for very long unless you are the captain of a ship, which that ship will probably be yours until you die, or they decide to make you an admiral because they like you.
Yeah, so, or until Jellicoe
arrives. A bad admiral. Yeah, exactly. And you get a really big belt buckle and some awesome shoulder pads.
Oh, man. Can you imagine an Admiral Jellicoe? I mean, you think he's a jerk as a captain. Gosh, give him a belt buckle and some shoulder pads. You won't even be able to talk to that guy.
I just want to call that guy a huge name right now, but I'm not going to. It's a family show, Chris. Yeah, I cannot imagine Admiral Jerkwad at all. Just terrible.
All right. Well, a few more character things here to talk about. I want to stay on the station actually for a minute because this one's really short, but just Quark and Odo. I love the fact that Odo will not give Quark anything at the end, but Quark takes that to mean that he loves me.
That man loves me. It was awesome. That is such a fantastic scene. And I think that it is so true. I think it's exactly what Odo meant, because Odo knew that if he did give it to Quark, it wouldn't mean the same thing.
Right. Okay, and I promise I will not take what you just said and make a clip out of it to put into other shows.
Okay, good. I don't know what I just said.
You just said if he did give it to Quark. No, but I like the ending for their relationship, because they were the two characters that I feel from the very beginning of the series meshed. And of course, it was because of Armin and Renee's past time working together on stage and all. But they meshed so well so early, and they were so consistent. They had this wonderful relationship all the way through the series. And for it to end like that was very, very fitting and true to the relationship.
Yeah, it feels right, because their relationship was always going to be antagonistic, but they had come to a place where they definitely respected each other and cared for each other more than they wanted to let on. And that relationship was never going to change. And so that's what made that scene so great, was because even if Odo had stayed on the show, that would still be their attitude towards each other.
Right. Okay, well, now we need to talk about one of your favorite topics to talk about here, old people loving. And because we have to talk about Dakot and Wynn and the end of their relationship here, where they both meet their end in the fire caves. And I guess last show we talked a bit about Wynn, right? That, you know, she was never really a believer, and so she wasn't going to be chosen as the emissary of the Paw Wraiths. She was just in it for her own gain here. But What did you think about how she was finally ready? You know, leading up to this, she couldn't believe that she had been deceived and that it was actually Ducat, and she was going to beg for forgiveness. But then at the end, she's ready to cast it all aside and come over to Ducat's side, and almost like the two of them were going to rule together with the Paw race. What did you think about the conclusion to their little storyline?
Well, apparently she'd just been listening too much Lord and, you know, thought that she was the queen bee and that she was going to rule.
Okay.
For anybody who knows music, you'll know what I'm talking about. I'm not singing it for you, but yeah, you get it.
This is Matthew's new thing, spoken word.
That's right. I'm doing the Shatner.
That's right.
It makes for a really interesting thing, Chris, because I don't think that there's anything genuine about Wynn until the last moments of her life. Mm-hmm. When she, I think, does truly have her eyes opened to everything that's going on around her, and she realizes exactly what she's done and where this power-hungry megalomania that she's given into has led her. And the moment where she does grab the book and, you know, she tries to end it all, I think that's the only true moment for Wynn, like where she's a true believer in something and she has a purpose beyond just her self-service, which I was glad that character finally got to go somewhere like that. You know, I thought it was a really interesting choice to finally have those eyes opened and her last moments be kind of a redemption for her. It's, again, it's not what I would have pictured, especially with where they had gone with the character. But I really bought it in that portrayal and the performance there by Louise Fletcher. I thought it was fantastic because even up to a few minutes earlier, you just still hate her guts. And then that moment, I feel like in some ways she kind of redeems herself just a little bit. And then, of course, she snuffed out as fast as possible. Right. And luckily, no old people loving seen in this episode, so fantastic. I'm okay with that not happening.
It was getting hot in there, but that was because of the fire.
That's right. No, and she did take off some clothes, just not all her clothes. Yeah, they weren't down there for some afternoon delight.
All right. Well, are there any other characters that you want to touch on? I mean, we could probably do a 4-hour show talking about every single character on the show.
Yeah, that's true. You know, the last couple characters, I think, you know, Ducat, obviously just the full circle for him of, I feel like that, you know, a lot of people kind of complain that he becomes a less interesting character. I would argue that Ducat does not become less interesting. Ducat finally just gives in to who he really is. That he kind of fights it for a long time, that kind of megalomania. But that he can't in the end. And he just, he finally has to just kind of give in. And he finds that one thing that he thinks is going to give him exactly what he wants, which is to rule the galaxy and have everybody love him. But, you know, and it leads him to his ultimate ruin. So I would argue that, you know, I know the writers had to make a choice. And they thought he had gotten too sympathetic. You know, Ira Stephen Bear says that in The Companion. But I also think it makes a lot of sense for how they had written the character in general, because it just works. And then the last character, I you know, we have made a ton of jokes on the show about Jake. But again, that last scene with him and Kira is just, you know, you want to know when tears start coming. It's so heartbreaking, and they don't even say anything, but just the looks that they both give each other, and watching them look out the window and both see the wormhole, and for them, you know, it means a lot of the same things. That's where the emissary is. And beyond that wormhole is where Odo is. And they both have that kind of longing just lost sense in some ways. And it's the way we all feel, actually, because we're pulling away from Deep Space Nine.
Oh, right, right, the final scene.
That shot and that feeling that those characters are feeling, we're feeling as well. And I think that's a very fitting end to the show.
Well, and I also think back to the fact that Jake came to the station with his father as this little bitty boy, and now he's this man standing there in the window, and his father's gone. And, you know, it just shows the station, you know, it became his home. That's his life. It's where he grew up. And then we all make that transition, you know, away from our parents. So I think, you know, he obviously, one of our big jokes on the show here, of course, is Sirach Lofton does not appear in this episode as we go through various episodes. And they could have done a lot more with him, but I think in the end, they gave him a meaningful send-off so that he was an important part of the show.
Yeah, and again, it was a very nice callback of the beginning, how it had begun with Sisko and his son going to this place. And what I loved is that Jake actually begins to think of the station as home before his father does. And then, you know, I remember the scene where Sisko has pulled out his masks and those his collection of artifacts from Africa, and Jake knows that his dad now feels like this place is home.
Okay. Yeah.
So those kind of things are, I think, are really interesting. And then, to have Jake left on the place that he now feels is home, but not quite as much home anymore, that dad's gone.
Well, let's talk about dad a little bit more here. When there's the final face-off between Sisko and Dukat in the fire caves, they go down into the fire, and then Sisko is with Sarah in the Celestial Temple. And she says, "Your time of trial has ended." And at that point, the end for Sisko is that he's sort of in limbo, right? He's in the Celestial Temple. The writing tells us that he's going to be there for a period of time. He's probably going to come back. There were different options here, different ways that they could have wrapped up Sisko's story. One of them is, of course, for him to die. One of them would be for him to just stay in the Celestial Temple forever at that point. And then they had one really unique one where they actually considered having Benny Russell hand over a script to Deep Space Nine, and then the entire series was actually just written by Benny Russell. In fact, Mike Max and I did a show on Commentary Trek Stars where we talked about Benny Russell as if he were an actual creator and he wrote Deep Space Nine. That was a really interesting discussion that we had. But those are different ways that they could go with this. But the first one I want to ask you about is, do you think that the message of Sisko's journey as the emissary would have been more powerful if he had actually died at the end?
That's tough.
Because I always felt that it was a bit of a cop-out for him to not actually die at the end, for him to be in the Celestial Temple, and especially for him to imply that he's going to be there for a while and then he's going to come back.
You know, I'll put this in religious terms. He's very much Jesus at this point. He goes to hell, and then he returns to heaven, and then he's going to come back one day. Mm-hmm. He's going to return. So, I mean, in a sense, who's to say that Sisko doesn't actually die as he's falling through the fire and the prophets bring him back to life? So, even in that sense, you know, the whole, again, it's a very spiritual illusion that we're talking about.
Well, you
here.
Could look and at so, it as he's half human. I don't know if half's the right term, half, but I guess, yeah. I mean, yeah. He's part human half and prophet. Part prophet, so his human body burns up in the fire, and his spirit goes to the Celestial Temple.
Exactly. And
but then for him to come back, he has to take human form again.
Which I don't think is beyond the prophets to be able to do, just because there's so much about them that we don't know. So, you know, it doesn't, because they're so ambiguous with the prophets, which is very, very smart, and they don't nail everything down with them. When they say that they have a power, it's It's like, okay, well, that makes sense because, you know, what we know of them so far, that's plausible. So it's not really a cop-out. It's just it's a good storytelling motif and idea of allowing yourself to have the back doors to be able to do things that... And people get frustrated with that because it seems too easy. But then, I don't know. Being a spiritual person, it doesn't bother me.
I guess when I say that I feel like it's a cop-out, I guess what I feel is that I almost feel like that's maybe where they wanted to take it, which that's his ultimate sacrifice. He fulfilled his purpose in being born in the first place. And once that purpose is fulfilled, he falls into the fire caves with Dukat. And that's the end of the journey. But they just couldn't quite go there because it's Star Trek and you can't just kill off the captain. And so there's this kind of little coda, like, yeah, he's not really gone, you know. He's still there.
Well, and then there's this whole other thing that they do say, that Sisko says to Cassidy, is that the prophets told him that they have much more for him to do. And it's very ambiguous, again. That's that thing that just drove me crazy in the future, in the novels, that this should be bigger.
Yeah.
Like, there's so... like
it kind of became like, we need to get Sisko back, you know, because he's Sisko and he needs to be there in the stories.
Yeah. Which I understand that we need Sisko back. That's fine. Bring him back. But then you really do, I think, need to deal with better the fact that this guy is part prophet.
Yeah.
He's not really all... I mean, that's something that they just really don't deal with well in
Yeah.
The fact that they've kind of stripped him of all that made him different and special now, especially in the novels, and they've just made him a captain of a starship again, is to me a disservice to the character and what Ira and the rest of the writers had created for this character. So,
although it is interesting that you keep referring in this show and the last one to the Trekland on speaker. So for those who don't know, this is a CD that you can get from Larry Nemechek, and I help Larry produce these things. But if you go to LarryNemechek.com, you can find it there. And if you have trouble finding it, tweet Larry on Twitter at Larry Nemechek. But what it is they're interviews from the time. And the third volume is about Deep Space Nine, and they're interviews with Ira and others right there as they were writing this episode. And so it's really interesting to find out what was really going on. But the reason I bring it up right now, Matthew, is that if you remember, I think it's on the disc, or it might be in part we didn't put on the disc, but Ira says that maybe they'll continue the story in the novels, what I wrote for the ending of Sisko here. And I found it interesting him saying that in 1999, and then they actually, yep, it's exactly what happened later on.
Yeah, it was really interesting because I remember him saying that, and then I was thinking to myself, yep, they do just that. And it makes me kind of wonder what he might have thought of
that. Well, I thought it showed what amazing storytelling mind Ira has, because even though the series is ending, he's still like extrapolating where these characters are going to go. So,
well, and this is exactly what he says. He says, "My life, my destiny, the prophet saved me, Cass. I'm their emissary, and they still have a great deal for me to do. But first, there's a lot I have to learn, things only the prophets can teach me." And so, even there, I mean, it really does sound like that his role as the emissary is not done. And there's so much left to explore there. And then we just never
know. And then
really
we don't know, yeah.
So. And so I'm just disappointed that that's not more of a story point. But
so it does show that there are some things in this finale that were not, you know, wild about the way they were handled, but...
Well, but in the finale, I'm okay with it. It's just in the later novels.
Yeah,
I'm not.
For me, in the finale, it's like, I'm
okay with it.
I like the moments. I just, there are other options which maybe would have been more satisfying for me. Well, what about this other one as we get ready to sort of wrap up here? Benny Russell. You know, I love the way that they picked up on that here in the final season, that Benny Russell was still around. What would you have thought if they had pulled a new heart on us And it turned out that this whole series was a dream. It was actually just Benny Russell writing this story.
I would have hated it. I would have been so
mad. Yeah, I think I would have too. Yeah.
That, you know, that they had pulled that. Because I think that is a cop-out. I think that they've done that on some other shows as
well. Do you remember the news radio where it turns out that the entire radio station is actually, it's a snow globe that Mr. James has on his coffee table? Everyone lives inside there.
Yeah, see, those kind of things make me just want to throw a snow globe against the wall, you know, because it's so obnoxious. And I don't know, I feel like it's just a disservice to the people who invested so much time. You know, we want to feel like it mattered in some way. You know, if it had all been just a dream or a novel by Benny Russell, that's a talk about a cutesy ending. I mean,
it's one of those, it sounds just clever, right? But then, if you really think about it, yeah, it would kind of gut the purpose of the series, I think.
Yeah, it's a little bit too clever for its own good.
Well, the last thing that we want to cover here to wrap up the whole thing is just, what is the legacy of Deep Space Nine? Because giving this episode a title, What You Leave Behind, it turns out it was really difficult for them. I think it's a wonderful title, but it wasn't easy for them to come to it. And Ira Stephen Baer pointed out that the name of the Next Generation's finale, All Good Things, is a statement. All good things must come to an end. But the title of this episode is actually a question. You know, what do you leave behind? You have to think about what each of these characters is letting go of as they move on with their lives, and this chapter in their lives is ending. And Ira said he hopes it's something that fans will ponder for years to come, and I think that's certainly been the case. But what do you see as the legacy of Deep Space Nine?
Oh, gosh, Chris. Wow, we could probably just talk about this question for a few hours.
Our next series, our five-part series. Yeah, what is the legacy of Deep Space Nine?
The legacy of Deep Space Nine. I think the legacy of Deep Space Nine is the enlarging and enriching of the Star Trek universe in a way that even the writers didn't know that was going to happen. I think, and I said this somewhere else, it was on another show, it might have been 602, we were talking about something, but the writers for Deep Space Nine created some tools for Star Trek that Star Trek didn't know it had. And then they used them to create, I think, a myth, a new myth inside the umbrella of Star Trek. And so if anything, I think the legacy of Deep Space Nine is its mythological transcendent nature. That the storytelling is reaching archetypes which then reach towards principles that we can continually look at age upon age, and they don't grow old, so therefore the story itself really doesn't grow old. Now, the look of the show may start to age, but the actual storyline and the characters and all of that feels fresh year upon year. And the fact that we've had this show around for so long, and I watch it, and for the most part, I feel like almost all the stories tend to be just as fresh, just as new, just as relevant, if not more now than they were when they were written. And that's just great storytelling. And I think that they gave Star Trek the ability to really make deep, lasting characters. Like, the show wasn't about space, the final frontier. It was about humanity and what it meant to be a human in the future, in this world that Gene Roddenberry had created. So it wasn't Aliens of the Week. It wasn't about the starships or anything like that, even though all of that helped inform. But more, it was about diving into what it really means to be a human and try to live out these principles of the Federation every single day. And in the end, I think what was really neat about the show is that characters that came to Deep Space Nine that weren't Starfleet characters were almost always won over by the good apostles that these characters were for the values that they believed in. Were they perfect? No. But almost always, I mean, you think about the characters like Odo and Garrick and Quark and all of these people who were kind of slowly won over by just the good witness of these 24th century, you know, Federation values. I think that's a really cool thing to see. I think that's the legacy of this show, of creating something special. And, you know, it was considered, and even Ira talked about it being kind of the redheaded stepchild.
Yeah.
And yet I think as we move forward, it's the golden boy. It's the gold standard for Star Trek series.
Yeah. Well, I agree with everything that you said. And what I would add to that is that we talk often about how, of all the series, DS9 is the series that pays the most homage to the original series. And it's often been criticized, especially when they created the show, that, like, how can you do Star Trek without having the Enterprise? And you mentioned a moment ago that Star Trek is about what it means to be humans in the future, but I think Star Trek is about what it means to be humans in general, not just in the future, but now, any time. And if you look at the original series, yes, they had these adventures, but there's so much there. It's the relationship between Kirk and Spock and Kirk and Bones and Spock. And I know the other crew members didn't really get in on that as much as the Triumvirate there did, but it's so much about that relationship, or Kirk and his ship as well. And when you get to the Next Generation, it becomes a lot more of the adventure, right? Going to the different worlds and the diplomacy of the Federation and such. And certainly Voyager was like that as well. And it's not to say that these other series didn't have character relationships, but I think that the idea that to have Star Trek, you have to have an Enterprise, or you have to have a lead ship in the case of Voyager, which is the only time we have a lead ship not named Enterprise, and a crew, you know, with six or seven people, and, you know, they're all like specific cultural identities from Earth. In order to have Star Trek, you know, people said, well, it can't be Star Trek's on a station. It doesn't go anywhere. You're not seeking out strange new worlds. But I think that the legacy of Deep Space Nine also is that it shows that the foundation of Star Trek, of what Gene Roddenberry's vision was, is broader than that. You know, you can put it in a very different wrapping, and not only can you make it work, but you actually can stay truer to what I think Gene's message was and what Star Trek was really exploring, even when you have it in this very different wrapping from all the other series. So I think Deep Space Nine showed that Star Trek is just much, much bigger than the Enterprise flying around.
And aren't we glad? I mean, it's the thought of, obviously, if they had just created another show kind of like The Next Generation, you know, they knew they needed something
which
different.
Which they almost did in season one, right? Like, yeah. They created this great framework, and then they're kind of not sure what to do with it, but luckily they settled in, and then they gave us something that was completely different, to borrow a line from Monty
Python.
And now
for something completely different.
Wow, Matthew, a giant foot just came down and smashed you. Oh, flashbacks to watching The Flying Circus.
Oh my gosh, right. I always think of that. And now for something completely different. A man with three buttocks. Right.
At least we never got one of those on Deep Space Nine.
No, so, we did not.
Surprisingly. All right. Well, there you have it. That's the end of our look at the final chapter. Part 10 of 9 has concluded. It's like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I love the back cover of the original edition anyway of Mostly Harmless, the fifth book in the increasingly inaccurately named Hitchhiker's Trilogy.
Yes.
So I hope everyone enjoyed our discussion of the final chapter. But of course, this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
But instead of it being a human being prejudiced against Vulcans because the Romulans look like Vulcans, the Vulcans are taking advantage of themselves looking like Romulans in order to be racist against Romulans.
Earl Grey.
So he's got the two armrests, and the right one says little, you know, Ensign, you know, Lamont, and a little arrow. And then the one on the left says Lieutenant Commander Data. Like a little arrow.
The orb.
But when they pull away from that window with Jake and Kira, and they pull away from the station, it's like they're closing the book. They're actually closing the back cover of the book, and it's the end of the story.
To the journey!
How do you feel, Char, about the Borg Queen?
Oh boy. I think the longer that I have watched Star Trek, the more I'm in the camp of, I don't know if I like her.
The Ready Room.
They want you to come across on Archer's side where he can be mad at Trip. But I have a really hard time being Archer being mad at Trip, because just think of if we still treated, you know, people of a different race like this.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
That can honestly be the reason they brought Wesley, because Wesley's got nothing else going for him there. I mean, yes, he can lead those kids, but that's just going to be by virtue of his age. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, he's 15 years old. Of course, all the other kids are going to look up to him, at least for a while. Then if he ends up being a total tool, then they won't.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Yeah, Learning Curve was never meant to be a season one finale. They were going to do the 37s, and then UPN wanted to open season two with it, and that totally didn't work either.
Man, you gotta say UPN really ooped it up.
Literary Treks.
What Jerry Taylor talks about with Catherine Janeway's life is it's kind of a series of her relationships. I mean, she should be doing all sorts of fantastic things, right? And instead, we're learning about her boyfriends.
Melodic Treks.
But there's a whole host of people that appear in Star Trek. As I said, most of it is classical, so it's Verdi, Vivaldi, Strauss, Troitschke, Harry Kim.
The 602 Club.
This really does have an impact on, I think, the entire, you know, comic book world. Dark Knight, Dark Knight Returns still have a huge impact in the way that people view Batman today.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. We're in iTunes, of course. Type itunes.com/trekfm into your web browser and it'll take you right over to our artist section. Great way to get our shows. You can subscribe there through the podcasts app, all the third-party podcatching apps on iOS and Android. You'll find us on Windows Phone, on BlackBerry, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud. Lots of ways for you to get our shows. You can go to our website and stream from that page. You can download the MP3 file. You can grab the RSS link, pop that into any application that you like. And while you're out there, especially on iTunes and on Stitcher, leave us a star rating and a written review if you have an extra minute. We love to hear what you think about the show, and that also helps other Star Trek fans find the orb as they're searching for Star Trek podcasts. And speaking of reviews, Matthew, we have a new review from Kid at Heart 33 in the US iTunes store. Left us 5 stars and said, "Deep and brilliant. This is my first podcast ever, but it's amazing. Started with episode 1 and just finished listening to all of them."
Wow.
"Each one is unique and enlightening. Fantastic work." So, wow. I mean, that's a lot of episodes to listen to.
That is fantastic. I'm so glad that you found the show and that you've been enjoying it. Thank you so much for going through and listening to the back catalog. And, you know, Chris, we talked about this, I think, at the beginning. This really, for us, is just a labor of our love for the show and for Star Trek in general. And we are so glad that so many people appreciate Deep Space Nine the way that we do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And speaking of that, ways to get in touch with us. The Babel Conference, which we mentioned many times during the show today. Come join us over there. I mean, that's a great way to get in touch with us and have a discussion. You know, that it's the hard thing about podcasts, right? Like, we can talk to you. You can talk back at us as you're listening, but we can't hear you. So we have things like reviews where you can share your thoughts like this. But the Babel Conference, we're both in there all the time. So go to Facebook. If you're on Facebook, type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and you'll see the Babel Conference pop up. It's a closed group, so it's just for our listeners. It's an extension of the shows. But click join, and I'll let you right on in there. We have great conversations there, especially about DS9. So I hope you'll join us over there. You can also send us email through the website, trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show, choose the orb. That'll come to both Matthew and me by email. You can send us a voicemail, speakpipe.com/trekfm is the URL for that. You just need the microphone on your webcam or your smartphone or your tablet. There's also a link in the left sidebar on the show pages on our website for that. And you can find us on Twitter as well. Our username is TrekFM. All right, Matthew, when you're not finishing up getting fitted for your fire-resistant suit so you can dive down in the fire caves and just make sure Dukat's not still hanging out down there somewhere, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with you, where we talk about the books and comics of Star Trek. So if you've enjoyed our talk here about the end of Deep Space Nine and you'd like to continue with us, we've actually been doing the Deep Space Nine relaunch. So it's a perfect time to just kind of jump in with us there on Literary Treks. We talked about the very first two books, Avatar, and then we've just continued on from there. We're slowly making our way through. Obviously, there's lots for us to get to on Literary Treks, especially when we have, you know, author interviews and other things like that. But it's just a great show. We have a great time there. A lot of laughs, especially when we have author interviews and right. We have those people on, which is just fantastic. So I hope everyone will check the show out there. Also do the 602 Club. Just talk about all things geeky, but that don't have anything to do with Star Trek, and have some great guests on there talking about some really fun things, whether it be something like Star Wars or, you know, something like what's happening on TV with all the great new comic series we've had there, or maybe even jumping into things like James Bond. We have so much stuff that we have planned for you guys, so I hope you'll join me there. Now, Chris, when you're not, you know, wishing you had a blindfold because you really don't want to see Dukat and Wynn just getting down, where can we find you?
We're never going to let that go, are we? So
it's your fault, Chris. I was not going to bring it up tonight, and then you did, so it's your fault.
I have a feeling there's going to be a future episode of The Orb where when you look over in the description field in iTunes, the first words are going to be old people loving.
Is that when we jump the shark with this
show?
Is that where
it might be? Well, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. As I mentioned, I'm also in the Babel Conference all the time on Facebook, so you can find me there. And I do a lot of shows on the network, of course, Literary Treks with Matthew, as well as Warp 5, Continuing Mission, Hyperchannel, The Ready Room, Matter Stream, and also I co-host the official podcast of Axanar with Axanar creator and executive producer Alec Peters. So go check out those shows if you want to hear more of my thoughts on the world of Star Trek. And Matthew, while we're, you know, giving people information on where to contact us, we want to also thank other people as well. We want to thank our associate producers, Norman C. Lowell, Ruth Ward, Lisa Stevens, and Will Wynn, for helping us bring the orb to everyone each week. And also, I want to thank John Mills, who is now a co-host on Commentary Trek Stars with Mike and Max. But of course, if you listen to The Ready Room, you know John. He comes on from time to time. John helped us both out. You were getting married, Matthew, and I was having an emergency here with my children. My daughter broke her clavicle, and John helped us get the show out to everyone last week by editing the orb for us. I usually do that, but John did it. And so we want to thank John for helping us out here on the orb too. And other ways that all of you guys out there can help us keep the orb coming to you every week is to become a patron of the network. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our goals and our milestone contribution levels there. You can set any amount that you'd like to contribute each month to the network. We have great things in exchange for you. You can become an associate producer yourself. You can become part of our content development group. You can sit in on show recordings. We have digital items as well. So we hope you'll support us over there. Your support is really, really key to helping us keep the orb coming to you every week. So we thank everyone who has contributed already. And even beyond that, we just really want to thank everyone out there who's listening to the show, because, you know, without you guys, we would not be doing this show. And we're glad that you're enjoying hearing us talk about Deep Space Nine. And one more thing, Matthew, I feel like we have to say this because someone is still going to ask. This is not the end of the orb. It's just the end of the final chapter, our series on that. So we're going to be back next week with another show. We'll do a few regular topics again. And I think pretty soon here, Matthew, we're going to jump into that season 6 arc.
Yeah, Chris, I'm excited about that. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm really glad that we're going to be going back and getting into that, because what a great series. I feel
like we kicked this off really close to the beginning of the year last year, right? So this next big series we're going to do will be, what is it right now? It's the middle of November. Thanksgiving's coming up over there, so it might be like January when we kick that off.
Well, that'll be great, Chris, and I'm really excited to be getting into that. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.